out of the 70s.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following rustic exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 70 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson. And today, going way back in the timeline, this is the earliest show I've ever done. It should be from the 1970s for the first time. That's why I did something a little different with the intro, doing the song there, which was a song entitled Against the 70s by Mike Watt, who is primarily known as a bass player who played in a lot of different groups over the years and collaborated with Eddie Vedder on that in 1995. And I thought that that would set the table pretty well. And also, not a lot of play-by-play to kind of insert in there, because we have Vince McMahon as our commentator, and there is no color guy at this point in October of 1977. This is WWF Championship Wrestling from October 29th, 1977. So this is 2.5 years earlier than anything I had done before. And say, well, why would you do this show now? Well, a couple of reasons. Number one, this is episode 70, so you might as well do the 70s for the first time. And if you recall last week, I was complaining about one part of the ECW shows that I always have kind of a hard time with, and I've gotten some good feedback on that show. But the note-taking that I have to do for those matches, because some of them go a little too fast, I thought maybe we should slow it down just for now. And I thought, what could possibly have a slower pace match than the WWF from 1977, the Worldwide Wrestling Federation? It certainly does not disappoint in a lot of ways. But before I get to all that, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown, and Twitter at GFAllentownPod. Give me a follow there. It's over 200 now. I think it was 206 when I looked, so it had surpassed 200, and I didn't even know it at the time. And you're probably listening to this show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon to support the Place to Be Nation with your Amazon purchases. And kind of got a little bit going on for both Place to Be Nation and the Pro Wrestling Only. As is my understanding, the ProWrestlingOnly.com site will be relaunched on July 1st, and I'm looking forward to some of the cool stuff that's in store there, particularly the classifieds section for kind of trading and exchanging wrestling memorabilia. I think that that's going to be just a really cool thing to be able to look at. And at Place to Be Nation, the written content is being rebooted, so there's going to be a lot more of that going forward. Write-ups on the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, which I'm actually, as I tape this, I'm watching the women's ladder match, and this is my preferred method of watching WWE pay-per-views these days. I don't need commentary. I can watch it on mute as I do this show, and I enjoy the pay-per-view a lot better that way, because I'm enjoying the hell out of this women's ladder match, because they're leaving it all out there, and I don't need Michael Cole's voice to just kind of, you know, say the same things that I've heard 100 times or repeat platitudes. I've said in the past that I value commentary probably more than the average fan. Obviously, I love Jesse. You know, I have my preferred announcers over the years. But I'm not going to, you know, let it bother me watching the modern product. It shouldn't be something where I can't watch because I don't like the announcers, which has been an issue with me with NXT, because I haven't been particularly thrilled with Mauro Ranallo's work or Nigel McGuinness or the other guy whose name I can't remember who never says anything. Oh, Percy Watson. But here on, like I said, on this show, you get Vince McMahon alone in his canary yellow suit where he's kind of doing the Howard Cosell cosplay and all that. But that's usually when he's doing the ringside promo interviews with the guys, which unfortunately we don't get on this show. Another reason why I would go back to the 70s for this, and I am going to Atlanta this coming weekend for the Braves and the Orioles, and I was going to do a segment called How Bad Are the Orioles Now, but they actually won today on Sunday as I'm taping this, so there's really not too much I can say. But 1977 is the year, of course, that Jimmy Carter became President of the United States, inaugurated on January 20th. And I've been to the Carter Museum in Atlanta, and it's actually not that bad. I prefer the Gerald Ford Museum in Grand Rapids, Michigan, but, you know, that's potato-potato there with those two guys. I don't think I'm going to be going back this time. I don't think I need to make two visits to the Carter Center. I could just go right to the brew pub directly from the airport because my flight won't be getting in until about 12:15 anyway, so I'm going to be watching Nigeria versus Iceland, at least the first half of that World Cup matchup as well. Oh, for those who were wondering what the TV theme song that I put at the beginning of the show was, it's certainly one of the more obscure ones, at least if you're under 50 years old. I was looking up, I said, what was the top television show in 1970? And I came across Marcus Welby, M.D., was actually the number one show for 1970-71 TV season. Not something that anybody really knows or cares about now, but it had a decent little instrumental there that I could put in, and that's the number one requirement for that a TV show must have to get in that spot. 1977, WWWF. This is the year that Billy Graham is the champion, the superstar, managed by the Grand Wizard, who we are going to hear from for a very extended promo on this program, and is certainly one of the biggest reasons why I chose this show. On the wrestling podcast About Nothing, Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis, they talked about managers a couple of weeks ago. And when they sent out like the Twitter on that, I replied back. I said, I know Heenan is number one, but I'm just going to give a shout out to the Grand Wizard. And it made me think, I haven't done any shows with the Grand Wizard in a very long time. And it kind of goes in with the slowing it down thing that was going on. So he's managing Billy Graham. He's heavily involved with an angle they were doing at this time in 1977. The manager of the year, which is something that I also covered for 1985, that they were running up to for the August 31st, 85 show that I did, I think about 10 episodes ago, where Hillbilly Jim was campaigning, and Heenan, and Blassie, and all those guys. Blassie's campaigning for 77 as well, against the Grand Wizard, Lou Albano, and on the babyface side, Arnold Skolland, who I'm going to have a few things to say about that, because Wizard gives a campaign speech in the middle of today's program. 1977 Worldwide Wrestling Federation was a little bit different. This is before they went to Allentown for their TV tapings. They were taping half the time in Hamburg, but their main championship wrestling taping was at the Philadelphia Arena, which is actually in West Philadelphia, of all places. I don't know if the Fresh Prince ever attended a TV taping.
In West Philadelphia, born and raised.
Yeah, things are slightly backwards from how it would be a few years later. For All-Star in Hamburg, Joe McHugh is the ring announcer. But here in Philadelphia, you have Gary Michael Capetta. Later on, Capetta works Hamburg, and when they move to Allentown, Joe McHugh goes to the main show in 78, as I understand it. So there's kind of a flip-flop there. There's part of the NWA, this is very much the Vince Sr. promotion in 77. So you have people like Dusty Rhodes floating in from time to time, where he would have wars with superstar Billy Graham over the world title, which was technically not a world title because it's part of the NWA, so it's, you know, subservient to the greater NWA world heavyweight title. Dusty Rhodes is actually on this show, along with other names like Bob Backlund, who they were building up all through the year 1977. Butcher Vachon is on the show, the tag team of Larry Sharp and Jack Evans, Dynamite Jack Evans. They have a bout late in the show, along with Chief J Strongbow and Peter Maivia, the High Chief, taking on Baron Mikel Cicluna and Moose Monroe, who, as I recall, became something of a cult hero at the Allentown tapings in around 79 or 80. If I recall my Titans of Wrestling podcast, there was a group of people chanting Moose at him. Unfortunately, there are only two episodes of All-Star Wrestling. They had uploaded a bunch of 70s episodes to the WWE Network, and only two of them from 1977. One of them is from November 12th, and literally nothing happened, nothing of interest there, which, you know, is just kind of too bad. One thing I should note about this arena in Philadelphia that kind of separated it a little bit from other promotions. You're used to the studio wrestling that you would see in Memphis or in Mid-Atlantic and a lot of other places. Here they are filming in an arena, the Philadelphia Arena. You could put, I think, 5,000 to 6,000 in that building. It's probably not sold out for what it is there. And while there was no smoke in the arena, it was certainly not a smoke-filled arena, it was the 70s, so things tended to be a little bit more dingy back then.
Oh, well, a lot of the stars from the 70s, they were not as hygienic as they appeared on TV. You think Mannix, for example.
Ah, yes, Mannix. That thing that Bob Reed was doing when he wasn't playing Mike Brady on the Brady Bunch during the early 70s. That's the only thing I really know about that show. I never saw it because I don't think it's ever aired in syndication or anything. So I can't wait to jump into this, so might as well dive right in.
Buddy, you're a boy, make a big noise, playing in the street, gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace, kicking your can all over the place, singing, we will rock you.
The day before this show originally aired, on October 28th, 77, Queen released the News of the World album, which featured We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions as the first two tracks on the album, which had a cover that was rather frightening and will never ever make my vinyl album Hall of Fame because I just don't like looking at that science fiction robot thing that they had on the cover for that. We Will Rock You is one of the first songs that I remember hearing at sporting events on a regular basis, especially during Celtics and Lakers games in the 80s. The Forum in LA, they would play that as the Lakers were bringing the ball up the court from time to time, and it's just something that I remember. Now, music during NBA games is so unbelievably commonplace that if there's no music being played, it just sounds weird. So we have Vince McMahon all by himself. I know, Vince, hosting a wrestling show by yourself can be very, very difficult, but we press on. And he runs down who's on today's show without any flair whatsoever. None of the Vince histrionics or anything, because remember, he's just an employee of his father at this point. So he's just kind of doing as he is told. And then we go to the ring, and once again, we get a return to one of my favorite tropes, the reading of the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission people.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another action-packed card of championship wrestling. These matches are sanctioned and supervised by the State Athletic Commission. Chief Deputy Commissioners are Jimmy Mina and Sam Skaversky. The timekeeper at the bell, J.P. Mina. Referees for this hour are Dick Worley, John Stanley, and Wee Willie Weber. And I'm your ring announcer, Gary Capetta.
All right, I have a few comments about this. Gary Capetta kind of sounds like he's on quite a bit of helium, especially compared with the ones he would do for All-Star Wrestling in 1981, which I have one of them on my YouTube channel, and subscriptions are always welcome to my YouTube channel. I have to get it over, I think, 1,000 or something like that to be able to have Google ad revenue again, which is mainly for my other stuff, but again, that's always welcome. So yeah, Capetta's voice sounds a little weird. He does not name who the attending physician at ringside is, so you don't get to hear if it's Dr. Judd Zaharian or not. I don't think he comes in until later on, and I think it was probably put in at his insistence since he was always kind of a camera whore and all that business. In this show, the taping of this show was done on October 18th of 77, which elsewhere in the New York territory, specifically the Bronx, New York, Game 6 of the 1977 World Series was going on, and that is the famous game there where Reggie Jackson hit 3 home runs, first ball swinging in the 4th, 5th, and 8th inning to seal the deal for the Yankees, their first World Series championship in over in about a decade and a half. I want to say it was 62 was the last World Series that they had won. That's all immortalized in the book The Bronx is Burning, and I recommend the book over the ESPN documentary, which was fine, but I actually read the book 6 months before the documentary came out, so I'm going to be a little bit snobbish about that. So our opening contest here is, we got the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, he's there, and his opponent on this day is Joe Turco, who I actually heard it as Joe Taco on one of the other All-Stars from 77 that I was watching. And he's billed as the Continental Nobleman, which if there's anything that is like they sounds better than it actually is, it's the word Continental always kind of leaves you disappointed, whether it was Continental Airlines when they were still in business before they merged with United, or a continental breakfast where at best you're going to get a tiny Danish or a tiny blueberry muffin that's probably stale and was made 4 days before. But he's not the star here. The American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, 12 years before he would don the polka dots, was a busy as hell man in 1977 and was one of the biggest stars in all of professional wrestling. He's in the Worldwide Wrestling Federation for this little run with Graham, as I mentioned earlier. He's an icon in Florida already by this time. He had won the Georgia Tag Team Championships alongside Dick Slater and held those for about a month. And in the year 1977, he was voted the second most popular babyface in Pro Wrestling Illustrated, trailing only Andre the Giant. And he is noticeably trimmer here. He's not a thin man by any means. He was never quite as thin as Dustin Rhodes was in his early WCW days from like 91 to 94 or anything like that. But he's certainly more athletic in 77. And as I said, he's one of the biggest stars in the world at this time. And he starts out by kind of dancing around, you know, throwing the jabs, and Turco just kind of begs off to get out of there. And then we get an arm wringer by Dusty, who then does that thing that often annoys me, but because Dusty is doing it here, I'm going to allow it just because he's so damn charismatic. He's asking the crowd if they want him to hit him with the elbow or whatever, like the confused game show contestant thing that I always complain about. But again, it's Dusty, so it's fine. Vince, as I said, he's not saying very much on commentary. He just kind of lets the action speak for itself. But then he blurts out the line that's become a staple of Greetings from Allentown.
Following wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
That is a turn of phrase that sounds very Vince McMahon in that there's more words than there probably should be. He could just say viewer discretion is advised, but I think that might have come off a little bit strong, and he decided to make it a little bit more wordy to somehow soften it a bit. And as for putting it into this show, I originally threw that in with the intro for episode number 11 just to add something new, but also because I had to quote Bill Watts on something during the course of that program where he said something derogatory about homosexuals, which, you know, so I kind of threw that in as a warning that there might be something. I am kind of recommitting myself to doing a clean show here, as I did get some praise. I think it was the 605 Super Podcast Board, or at least the Facebook version of it, where I was recommended as a show that works clean. So I think I'm going to double down on that and try to avoid F-bombs as much as possible and spot the S-bombs not very regularly. An Arm Breaker by The American Dream. And this, the arm work in these matches, I'm just taking that to mean we have to establish that this is the 1970s, and there's no better way to do that, because we can't, you know, disco's not big yet or anything, but by working the arm constantly in a wrestling match, that is the easiest way to establish it. You get one shot by Turco in the corner, but then we get the arm bar again. And Vince does explain what the American Dream means in the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes.
Dusty Rhodes will tell you about his dream. And they're giving him an opportunity. Rhodes dreaming when he was a child that one day he'd be one of the top professional wrestlers, the son of a plumber. It was a rough road to go, but unquestionably Dusty Rhodes right up there at the peak right now.
The thing that was so interesting about this match is Vince McMahon calling a Dusty Rhodes match before he's ever in charge of anything, and before you have him wearing polka dots and him poking fun at the American Dream and all that sort of stuff. You can tell that Vince really, really likes him, and it kind of made me wonder that could Dusty have been that Hulk Hogan star in a national expansion. He might have been a little too old. He wouldn't have had the longevity that Hulk Hogan would have had in that run up through 92 and 93, although Dusty was full-time active up through 91. The last few years of that was not quite the same in the ring. And I don't think Dusty Rhodes had any real desire to go to New York and work for the WWF and work for Vince, because he could write his own ticket down in Florida when he gets the booking job with Jim Crockett Promotions. That's probably even more lucrative than he would have been in the WWF, unless he's the absolute top babyface. And he's on top where he is, so why should he go somewhere else and settle for maybe being the number two babyface? So I'm kind of thinking it through from his perspective. And Vince probably, you know, wanted to poke fun at him because he was the most legitimate competition, at least from a mind for the wrestling business perspective, that Vince would have in his 1980s expansion. One other factor that I just got to throw out there is that Dusty is such a big star by 1983 and 84 on kind of a national level that he would have been much harder for Vince McMahon to rein in and control, at least in the early going, in the direction that he wanted to go. Because, as I said, Dusty could kind of write his own ticket. He had his own ideas for how to do things. He had booking ideas. He came up with Starcade. He came up with all the WCW pay-per-view names. And Vince probably looks at something like that and says, well, I'm going to have the last say, so there's obviously going to be a conflict there. So that's kind of why you couldn't have a marriage of Dusty and Vince. But as I said, Vince clearly likes him as he's in this match. Eye poke by Turco, but that's really his last little bit of offense. As Dream lands a series of rights with the Ali shuffle and then hits an elbow, but just is merely setting up for the big bionic elbow running off the ropes and drops it for the win, the same finisher that he would use for years and years, including his WWF run in 89, 90, and into the beginning of 1991. So the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, in the Worldwide Wrestling Federation in 1977. And you You're not going to believe this. That song by Debbie Boone, You Light Up My Life, which is actually a cover of somebody else's written song that was from earlier in the year, is a top 10 of all time to this day Billboard Hot 100 song. I couldn't believe it. It was 10 weeks number one in 1977. I suppose it ran up against all the disco songs that came later in the year, because Saturday Night Fever comes out in theaters in December of that year. Every time I see her singing that song from like the footage of the time, it's got kind of a weird, creepy vamp to it, where she almost looks like she's in a cult and is being forced to sing the song. But, you know, she's the daughter of Pat Boone, and I'll just leave it at that. So our next match here features two men with very interesting build hometowns. We got perennial enhancement talent Steve King, billed from Panama City, Panama, taking on Butcher Vachon, who is accompanied by Captain Lou Albano, who is billed from the wilds of Canada. Which, while interesting, you know, there are plenty wild areas in Canada, I suppose. Panama City, Panama, very much in the news, or actually the whole country of Panama was very much in the news at this time in 1977. The Panama Canal Treaty had just been signed about 6 to 8 weeks before this, in early September. And that was kind of a deal that the United States had to do, because you constantly had these riots happening in Panama because of the status and how the U.S. basically had this carved out territory in the middle of Panama, you know, from building the canal early in the 20th century up to that point. There were some riots in 1963 and 64 with college students, and it was getting worse and worse. And they cut the best possible deal, I think, that they could at the end of the day, because you weren't going to be able to hold on to it forever, and you got a pledge of neutrality out of it. Still, it was a bit of a battle to get it ratified in the United States Senate, as there were two votes, because there are two parts of the treaty, and they both passed by 68 to 32, so only by a two-vote margin, because they needed two-thirds to actually ratify the treaty. And eventually, the full control of the canal was turned over in 1999. Before that, you had the weird situation of the Panama Canal Zone, the U.S. territory, as I alluded to. There are actually a few famous people who were born in the Canal Zone. John McCain was, and somebody had decided to make an issue out of the fact that he was born there in 2008. So you had the two major candidates, where you had these birth conspiracy nonsense things going on. It was actually codified in law that those who were born in the Panama Canal Zone to U.S. nationals were U.S. citizens. Rod Carew, a famous baseball player, was born in the Panama Canal Zone. And probably the last famous person that you could get that who was born there is Sage Steele, the female anchor on ESPN. I think she does NBA telecasts. So enough on Panama. About Butcher Vachon, who is our star here. We've seen him on Greetings from Allentown in 1984, at the very end of his career. At this time, he just kind of floated in to the New York territory, working really just underneath guys on house shows, is pretty much the record that you have on him for much of the year. And Steve King, there's no more underneath guy than him. From the late 70s to the early 80s, he was nothing short of an enhancement machine for the WWF and the WWWF. He actually passed away, as this show drops on June 21st, 2018, he actually died on June 21st, 2008. So he passed away exactly 10 years to the day of this show's release. To that point in 1977, Steve King had one win on his resume, and it was against a Carlos Vega at the Zembo Mosque in Pennsylvania. There is one listener to the show who has a great Twitter name. It's one of my favorite Twitter names ever, Zembo Mosca. Just a quick shout out there. And I believe the Zembo Mosque was mentioned on the Titans of Wrestling as the place where jobber dreams come true, because a lot of those guys, there would be jobber versus jobber matches, so somebody had to win, so guys would pick up their only win or one of their very few wins at that particular location. There's not really much to speak of in this match. They're over by the ropes and Albano hits Steve King a couple of times as if Vachon needs the help. He's not very dynamic on offense. Vince, though, does chip in, talking about the status of Captain Lou Albano's stable.
Albano also happy to have the Golden Terra in his stable, and also happy to have once again Ken Patera, as Patera has been reinstated.
Better off calling him the Golden Terra, because he was actually later known as the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Doherty. As the Golden Terror, having some success early on in his career. And Ken Patera had a very brief suspension angle. I had thought that it would be longer period of time that he would have been suspended, maybe to heal an injury or something. But he was suspended for his actions on the October 1st episode of Championship Wrestling. He was manhandling a jobber and basically just breaking the rules, normal stuff. And he suspended, and it was on the previous show on October 22nd that he was reinstated by the WWF president, Willie Gilsenberg. And it was agreed that he and Albano would pay a $5,000 fine. It was really less about rules and more about establishing Ken Patera as a feared killer character at that time. Vachon, he gets drop-kicked by King, but that sort of leads nowhere, and he just continues the deliberate beating of the Panamanian hero here. He chokes him with the shoulder strap from his singlet. Again, not exactly the most dynamic offense that you're going to get out of Butcher Vachon. The big boot off an Irish whip, followed up by a splash, not a particularly good-looking splash, and not off the ropes or anything, just sort of running the ropes, a splash finishes it. What I do notice about Butcher Vachon is he had a certain tick that I noticed, because he did it like four or five times in this match. He liked to do the hands clean thing, where he would like wipe his hands together as if to say, well, I'm just wiping the sweat off or wiping the dirt off my hands, you know, manhandling this guy. He really liked to return to that. I don't know if that would inspire the Alanis Morissette song Hands Clean, but who really knows? Butcher Vachon picking up yet another win against an underneath talent on WWF television.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
One thing that takes some getting used to for a show like this from so long ago is there's no update segments between the matches to sort of break it up. And in fact, not even any promos except for the Grand Wizard promo we're going to have coming up. It's just kind of match, 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 which is fine. It's how things were done. So it's just kind of representative of the style. I just wish that there were more promos or whatever that I could comment on. And our next bout is Silvano Souza taking on Dewey Robertson. And Silvano Souza is from East Providence, Rhode Island. I'm sure he's a longtime, dear, close, personal friend of JT Rosero. And his cage match record is nothing to write home about. 19 wins, 88 losses, 6 draws, whatever with that. It says, though, I was particularly fascinated by the fact that it says he was trained by Bruno Sammartino and Giant Baba. I thought, wow, that is quite the interesting pair. I don't know how that was arranged, but I'll take their word for it. He is a New England Pro Wrestling Hall of Famer, just like the aforementioned Pete Doherty, though he doesn't seem to get the ink that the Duke of Dorchester gets. Probably because he's a normal human being and talks like a normal human being, is what I would guess. Dewey Robertson, if that name doesn't ring a bell, This is somebody who would go on to much greater fame later on. And if you just looked at him here, you'd never know that he was going to become the missing link some 6 years down the road. This is his debut in the New York territory. Robertson had been mainly a star in Maple Leaf, so in the Toronto area, the original MLW, Maple Leaf Wrestling. But it was in 1983, Mid-South, where he would become the missing link, and his career would take off a little bit with that character change. The most notable thing to me about the missing link is that he was 44 years old when he changed into that character and kind of revived his career at that point. It's kind of interesting. It feels like kind of a really advanced age for something like that. For by way of comparison, Ric Flair turned 44 years old in 1993. So picture him changing into a character like that. Bob Backlund turned 44 that same year. And Backlund might actually be the closest comparison I can think of, just off the top of my head, of a guy who changed character so drastically from something that had been established for a long time in his mid-40s. I want to say Backlund was either 44 or 45 when he goes into the crazy snaps Bob Backlund kind of character. Robertson would battle substance abuse issues for pretty much his whole career and his whole life. So the fact that he was able to, you know, get a little bit more notoriety as the missing link, but it's, you can't think of two things that are more different than him as Dewey Robertson, which is more like your normal amateur wrestler sort of guy, like a pure pro wrestler, what they were looking for in the 1970s. Sure, there were outlandish characters back then, but something like the missing link, I'm not sure. I mean, maybe it would have flown just kind of under the same guise as George the Animal Steel or any of that. Vince, for his part, calls him a good-looking young athlete. So, kind of interesting that, you know, he would go on and become what he did. We have the chain wrestling at the beginning, a drop toe hold. As I said, he's very much the amateur wrestler sort of thing. This is an arm drag. You get an accusation of a hair pull by Souza. So now I'm starting to have flashbacks to the ECW matches from last week where we had the exact same thing going on. Get some arm work. Remind us that we are firmly in the 1970s. And Vince, Dewey Robertson, he is from Canada. So Vince, I don't know if this is just kind of a stereotype or if this is true.
Dewey Robertson, part of the former Canadian Tag Team Championship combination. Also, I might add, quite a hockey player, quite a skater.
Now, for a minute, I thought it was one of those Canadian stereotype things of, well, he's from Canada, so clearly he likes hockey or all that, or he's a good skater. But apparently it was true, at least according to the account of Jim Ross, who wrote up a little obituary for Dewey Robertson when he passed away a number of years ago. He also noted that Dewey once told him that he lived in a nudist colony for a very brief period. I don't know what would like get you to that point where you would want to join a nudist colony. I mean, you really have to feel committed. I don't think I could do it. I'd have to get myself in a hell of a lot better shape than what I am. As for hockey, the NHL in 1977 was kind of lousy in that everybody was from the same place. The league was over 85% Canadian. And say what you want about how the game has evolved over time, but I think it's better that you have people from all different countries now. And also back then, the talent pool, with it being confined to mostly the United States and Canada for a variety of different reasons, you also had 18 NHL teams plus at least 8 to 10 WHA teams as well. And it's just, the whole league was watered down, which is why I don't give the same love to the late 70s Montreal Canadiens that everybody else does. The Islanders of the 80s and the Oilers of the 80s were superior because the league was a much tougher landscape at that time, because there's 21 teams and there's only one major league that everybody goes to, whereas the Canadiens just feasted on a watered-down league. Now back to wrestling. Shoulder block by Robertson. Then he runs the ropes. Souza drops down. Robertson kind of steps over the top of him and then lands a drop kick when Souza gets to his feet. Irish whip and into an abdominal stretch. Now, I'm waiting for Gorilla Monsoon's voice to just get piped in somehow. Even though he's an active wrestler in 1977, I'm just conditioned because I noticed that Robertson does not have the toe locked on the abdominal stretch, and I'm waiting for Gorilla to come on down and tell us how the hold is not being applied correctly. But before any of that can happen, Souza ends up submitting to the hold, and a very dominant win for Dewey Robertson in his first match on WWF Championship Wrestling. And then Vince, with one of those jinxing phrases of his, weighs in on this.
I'm quite certain we'll be seeing more of Dewey Robertson in the weeks to come here.
You beat Dexy's Midnight Runners.
Well, you haven't heard the last of them.
Just seems like every time Vince says that line of, we're going to be seeing a lot more of him going forward, that you never actually see him on the show. And in fact, he never appears on Championship Wrestling ever again. And he said specifically, you're going to be seeing a lot of him on Championship Wrestling. He was on All-Star Wrestling the following week. And then 3 weeks later, he was on the losing side of a tag match, also on All-Star Wrestling. But he would appear again on Championship Wrestling on the June 8th, 1985 episode, after he had returned to the WWF, this time in the Missing Link character. I'm not sure how I feel about everything getting discoized around that point in time in American music. Felt like Rod Stewart eventually, like, go all disco and everything. But I guess, you know, it's a step to sell albums. I mean, even you're even doing it with the freaking Star Wars theme there, which was in the top 10 on that week in 1977. It's just kind of crazy to me. It reminds me, when I was in the 7th grade, you'd have, like, you know, the normal classroom stuff, and then you'd have to go to, like, a different classroom for, like, geography and study skills. And one thing that I remember from my study skills class was, this was 1991, I guess it would be, around that time. Somebody had carved into my desk, "Disco sucks." And I was so fascinated by this. I would look at it every day like it was the Dead Sea Scrolls or something. I was like, what happened to the person who carved "Disco sucks" into my desk? Like, what happened to them? What did they have against disco? So I kind of would, like, research this for as much as you could in 1991 and 1992, and I really didn't get anywhere beyond a lot of white kids in the suburbs were resentful, particularly ones who were more fans of rock music or whatever. It goes a little bit deeper than that, but yeah, "Disco sucks" being carved into a desk and me having that desk in 1991. Oh, well. So we got Bob Backlund up next. And this is pre-world title reign Bob Backlund, as he is being built up. He is taking on Pete Reeves, who checks in with a cage match record of 4-39-3. So not very good there. But he did have one very interesting match that caught my attention on his cage match profile. He had a draw versus, quote, The Undertaker on October 28th, so the night before this would have aired. And of course, that took place at the Zembo Mosque, just like everything else. That Undertaker was Hans Schroeder and not Mark Calloway, who would have been about 14 or 15 years old at the time. Bob Backlund's, the way he was rolled into the WWF was rather interesting in that you didn't see him on really any house shows. Maybe you could maybe count him on one hand, the number of house shows he was doing over the course of the year. He was on TV only to introduce him that way. Kind of wonder if maybe there was some resentment for that. I don't know. He never addresses it in his book. And he never lost. He's clearly being built up to be the next guy, but slowly but surely. And he came in very highly regarded for his work in Florida and Amarillo, particularly by Terry Funk, who Bob Backlund in his book talked about his admiration for Terry Funk in terms of putting him over in Amarillo. They worked a TV time limit draw when Backlund was just breaking in. That probably would have been about 74, I think, was the time frame on that. And it really helped advance his career. He kind of plucked him from Tri-States territory, put him in Amarillo. Bob Backlund and his wife then move out of Amarillo to go to Florida. And as it turns out, they never came back there. They had left their stuff with a variety of people. And he had success in Florida and St. Louis as well, where he was the NWA Missouri champion, which, as territorial titles go, it was one of the big ones to have because it was generally considered to be kind of a stepping stone to the NWA World Heavyweight title, which was mostly controlled out of that St. Louis office in the years before Jim Crockett kind of assumed control of it after Starrcade 83. A lot of that was done in the Sam Muchnick office out of St. Louis. As we get started, Bob offers the handshake, and it's refused by Reeves, and then Backlund gets a quick go-behind. As Backlund has the move locked in, he gets some helpful advice from one of the wiseacres in the Philly crowd. Don't hurt him, Backlund, he's got diaper rash. Which can happen if he was incontinent or paralyzed, which he's clearly not. So it's highly unlikely that he would have had diaper rash. So the wrong diagnosis by him. But, you know, he's just trying to help. You know, the Philadelphia fan always trying to be helpful in everything they do. They do switches and they kind of reset. And a fireman's carry takeover and Backlund gets a wrist lock. Just generally out-wrestling the man is the easiest way to put it. And then he locks in a short arm scissors. Now, a lot of times you would hear Gorilla Monsoon say, oh, there's not going to be any short arm scissors in figure four leg locks. And you say, well, we never see a short arm scissors in any of these matches nowadays in, you know, the late 80s anyway. No, Bob Backlund, you go back to 1977, he is doing a short arm scissors on TV. And I think Reeves, looking at him, I think he bought his tights at the Baron Von Raschke store, although with this being the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, it might be the George Steele store, although Von Raschke is in the intro for Championship Wrestling, doing that thing where he shows the claw and then he turns awkwardly to the camera, which I don't quite get what the Baron's deal was there. It's like he's doing the Mr. Roper thing of looking into the camera after he cracks on his wife in Three's Company, which would have been the style at the time, with it being 1977 and all. I'm also interested, there's an elderly woman with a cane just kind of walking around ringside, which you'd never see that 10 years later, because I think she's inside the ropes, so she's between like the audience and the ring. Just really kind of a different time. And this is almost like an amateur wrestling match. It's almost like Backlund went out there to say, I want to do a match that looks like an amateur wrestling match, but with a pro wrestling ethic to it. Because eventually stuff, you know, happen. You have to do certain things in a pro wrestling match. Like, you are going to have to throw a punch, which is not something you could do in amateur wrestling. There's one loud dude in the crowd who is really pro Pete, which I endorse. That's fine. As another short arm scissors is locked in. Vince, during this match, he's very, very quiet again. He's not saying much of anything. I'm not interpreting that as him being anti-Backlund, because I do think that Vince Jr. was at least somewhat of a supporter of Backlund being in the company, although sometimes there would be some awkwardness when there would be promos, Backlund, although that might have just been his general manner and way. Reeves does go to the eyes and scores with some right hands, so there's your pro wrestling element finally entering in. And he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran, and Backlund leapfrogs and then gets a drop kick and then a backdrop of his own, which was kind of weird because you have a backdrop countered and then the guy immediately runs back into it as they switch out. And then he sets him up for the atomic drop of doom. And you'd say that Bob Backlund's finisher was an atomic drop. It seems like such a joke to somebody who's brought up even on 1980s wrestling. But to that, I would say, look, it's 1977. You have to factor things in by the context of the time. I don't want to go all Dave Meltzer here and, you know, God, I don't even want to address that whole thing about how matches from the past cannot be reevaluated or whatever. Oh, God, what a complete mess he is on Twitter. This is a running atomic drop. So this is not something that's you're just lifting Dino Bravo in the air and dropping him on your knee. You're actually running him across the ring. So that adds to the move as well. Not the most dynamic victory for Bob Backlund, but he is a wrestler with a capital W, which is very important. Again, in the context of the time, that is exactly what they're looking for. It's what Vince Sr. had in mind for his next babyface champion, because he's got superstar Billy Graham in there right now. He knows exactly when he's going to lose the title, as the story goes, the following February. He had won the title in April off Bruno Sammartino in Baltimore. Backlund is a departure from the previous babyface champions in a couple of ways. He's not an ethnic guy. That makes him very different from Pedro Morales, who's clearly there to appeal to the Puerto Rican population in the cities of the Northeast, or Bruno, who is an Italian strongman, is effectively his gimmick. Backlund is just the All-American Boy, which is part of the title of his 2015 autobiography, which I reviewed in parts on section309.com. I think I only got halfway through it, something I really need to return to at some point. He's the All-American Boy, so he's not an ethnicity, he's not playing on that necessarily. But he's more of a pure technical wrestler than either of the guys who come before, who showed a little bit more fire and, you know, your traditional babyface fire. Backlund, more of a traditional amateur wrestler. So something a little bit different for the Vince Sr. model.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Bad Boys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and HistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
It's now time for the one interview that actually takes place on this show, which I'll admit does kind of make it stand out instead of having all these local promos in a row where you might not necessarily remember anything that happens. You get this standalone thing with Vince McMahon at the commentary position, along with the Grand Wizard, who is just so unique, Ernie Roth. Here is this diminutive Jewish gay man who wears clothes that are straight out of Boyd Pierce's or Don Cherry's closet, but yet somehow looks good on him. He's a character that, when I watch him, I'm reminded of why wrestling is so great. The fact that something like this can exist and be so unbelievably entertaining. And, oh yeah, by the way, the name Grand Wizard of Wrestling, you're saying, isn't that the name of the head guy in the Ku Klux Klan? And like, yes, Ernie Roth actually chose that name on purpose as a big screw you to the KKK. Years before this, in Detroit, he managed the original Sheik, but under the name Abdullah Farouk. So again, it's just the contrast of this small Jewish man who also happens to be gay, who is now playing an Arab whatever and alongside the Sheik. It's just so amazing. And of course, the tragedy of the Grand Wizard is that he passed away when he did, in October of 1983. So you never got to see him as part of the national expansion. So he kind of is forgotten, I think, a little bit as one of the three wise men, him, Captain Lou Albano, and Classy Freddie Blassie. The thing that I liked most about the three wise men, as opposed to, let's say, the late 80s troika of Heenan, Jimmy Hart, and Slick, is that the three wise men seemed very, very different from each other. Not to say that the, you know, Hart and Slick and weren't all different themselves, but they were. Wizard, Blassie, and Albano were different, but all seemed to be presented somewhat as equals in that they all had relative strengths and maybe relative weaknesses, and one guy would be up at one point and the other guy would be down at various points. And in 1977, Grand Wizard is the manager of superstar Billy Graham, a guy who, quite frankly, could talk for himself, but as I've said many times, the policy generally was you're a heel, so you need a manager, and Wizard was the one who made the most sense to go with superstar Billy Graham. He had also managed the former Worldwide Wrestling Federation champion Stan the Man Stasiak back in 1973, so he's done it a couple of times. So he's campaigning here for the Manager of the Year, something that had kicked off weeks and weeks before this. And the difference between this one and the later one is that they don't give you an address to vote. It's kind of unclear how the balloting, if there actually was any, if it wasn't just a 100% work and fabrication, how this election was going to take place. There's four candidates, the three wise men, and then the fourth being Arnold Skolan, the manager nominally still of Bruno Sammartino, who is not around as much these days. And they had released some early exit returns, I don't know how you would put it, that stated that the Wizard was not in the lead at that point. So he's here to kind of make his case for being the top manager in the promotion for the year.
Well, this I find awfully hard to believe, Mr. McMahon, for this reason. Arnold Skolan, I will grant you and I will grant everybody else, Arnold Skolan was Bruno Sammartino's...
Is Bruno Sammartino's manager. What do you mean?
If you would let me finish, he was his manager during the time he was champion. Bruno is no longer champion. The champion is gone. I am the man who now represents Superstar Billy Graham, the champion. I am the man who guided Stan the Man Stasiak to his championship. I am still the only manager that has ever had not one but two champions. Therefore, it's inconceivable for me to believe that the public is not intelligent enough to realize that I am the super brain, I am the genius, I am the man who represents the champion now, and for them to vote for Arnold Skolin is like living in the past. It's like voting for Franklin Roosevelt. He was a great president, but he's no longer with us, just as Bruno Sammartino is no longer world's champion. Superstar Billy Graham is. Now, when I am the guiding light, when I am the man who took him and made him successfully the WWF champion, it is only simple, pure logic that I should be not just the manager of the year, the manager of the generation. That's the award that I should have.
Holy Lord, that was amazing. From how Wizard doesn't let McMahon derail him when he interrupts him, when he points out that Skolin is not seen with Bruno because Bruno's not really around anymore, comparing him to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which is kind of funny because FDR hung on to the job like a pope, and you get Skolin who hangs with Bruno the entire time that he's champion, and then later this gets proven out when Backlund becomes champion. Skolin hangs around with him for the 5.5 years. He's really kind of like the Phil Jackson of managers. Like, oh, Jordan with the Bulls, okay, he's retiring, I'm leaving here, and I'm going to go straight to Kobe and Shaq and the Lakers. I'm going to hang out there until that implodes, and then I'll do something else. I'll come back when Kobe has his act together and we get Gasol from the wherever the hell he came from when in that trade that they stole him. I think it was the Memphis Grizzlies. Really kind of bothersome to me, and I'm glad that Wizard is sort of bringing that to light. He uses the word inconceivable in a promo, which is what I asked for Paul Heyman, but we're not going to see him on TV for months and months because, you know, Brock Lesnar, God forbid you put the world champion on TV at any damn point. While I may be loving this myself, it is a quintessential heel promo from the arrogant perspective. And Wizard kind of comes off in some ways, this is not to be a shot at any particular person, comes off as one of those haughty, arrogant Democrats of, how could you vote for the Republican candidate here? I am way smarter. I mean, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I've voted for all manner of different parties in elections over the years. But it seems to be more of a problem of the American left where we are much smarter than your side, and then it ends up alienating some of the voting base. So Wizard might want to, you win more friends with honey than with vinegar, I would say. Wizard is not done here by any means whatsoever, but Vince, being a political reporter, I guess, of sorts, in this case, is pressing him on certain areas.
The manager of the generation.
Absolutely, the manager.
Notwithstanding your abilities to guide various individuals onto the championship, do you think that in itself is alone sufficient to become manager of the year? Is that reason enough to be manager of the year? Let's take into consideration sportsmanship. Let's take into consideration the abilities of Arnold Skolin, who has guided Bruno Sammartino, you have to admit, the greatest wrestling champion of all time. He's done things that no one's been able to do.
You may think in your mind, and it's your opinion strictly, Mr. McMahon, that Bruno was the greatest champion of all time. I happen to firmly believe in my heart and in my mind that superstar Billy Graham is and will be forever the greatest champion of any time. There has never been anyone.
Stan the Man wasn't much, was he?
Stan the Man was a great champion in his own right. You have two great champions. That's why I say I am the man who produces champions. Now, you want to talk about sportsmanship? You don't get paid playing baseball for striking out. You get paid for hitting home runs. If you're a pitcher, you get paid for winning games. I create champions. I make champions. Therefore, that means I am the manager of the generation.
All I could think of hearing that was sportsmanship. What a load of crap. from Steve Austin 20 years after this. 1977, again, completely different world. But he makes his case, all in spite of that. You don't get paid for striking out, as he put it, which made more sense in the baseball of the time when contact hitters were more valued. And by the way, I do think that one of the next Moneyball concepts of undervalued players in baseball is guys who actually do make contact. Because the way things have swung now is guys strike out so much, and the numbers between now and 40 years ago bear that out, that you're finding fewer and fewer contact hitters, and just by putting the ball in play occasionally, you can make things happen. Although, hitting home runs, as he put it, you get paid for hitting home runs. That is true. Strikeouts are an unfortunate cost of hitting home runs much of the time. I mean, Aaron Judge hits 50 home runs, but he also struck out 200 times. Nobody struck out that many times back in the 70s. Wizard does have words of praise for his rivals Blassie and Albano, saying that they're perfectly good managers, but that he is just a little bit better. But to kind of close out makes his case, he knows that his number one enemy in this voting is Arnold Skolin. So he just goes, to coin a phrase, all in on Arnie.
Does it bother you that you're trailing in the votes?
It certainly does bother me, because I feel that I should be so far ahead. I don't think Arnold Skolin should even be in the running. I don't even consider him a manager, because the one thing Skolin has never been accused of by anyone is being too bright, and that's simply because
you were in the lead. There's no question of that. Initially, you jumped out to quite a commanding lead. It was then we interviewed various individuals. One of them was Bob Backlund, and Backlund said that he'd vote for Arnold Skolin. From there, of course, the rest is history until now, and you obviously are making a plea for more votes.
Absolutely. I am asking the people to use your head. Think clearly as to who the greatest is, and the answer will come up, the Grand Wizard. It will not be Arnold Skolin, that I can guarantee you, because out of all the managers in professional wrestling today, I can tell you in all truthfulness and complete honesty, I have less respect for Skolin than any other man.
Well, we'll see if the Grand Wizard's logic has any effect on the voting, as this contest is coming to an end here in just a couple of weeks. The Grand Wizard of Wrestling asking for your vote for Manager of the Year, and we shall return in a few moments. We
thank you for your time. I deserve the vote. I deserve it.
The Grand Wizard.
It's interesting to me that they are invoking Bob Backlund's name rather than anybody else in an effort to kind of nudge things in a particular direction, if there is any actual voting at all, because at no point during this does Vince say, get your votes in, write to this, get your name on our catalog list. That stuff didn't exist back then. It was Backlund, as I said, is being slowly built up for the world title win, which is still another 4 months away. This is something that is kind of lost to history, this 1977 Manager of the Year business. It's not something that's been played up in any sort of way, but it was one of the more memorable angles of that year from the television in the promotion. And you're wondering, well, did Wizard end up winning? I mean, I find it hard to believe that a heel would end up on top. The results of this would come out on the Championship Wrestling episode that would air 2 weeks later on November 12th. Unfortunately, the All-Star Wrestling of November 12th, 1977, that is on the WWE Network, makes no reference to any of this stuff going on. You would never know that there was a Manager of the Year thing, even though it was the same week listed as the same day. It's entirely possible that it was mislabeled. I haven't cross-checked it or anything. It is on YouTube, the entire ceremony. And despite being the manager of superstar Billy Graham, the champion of the promotion, and of the previous champion prior to Bruno, Stan Stasiak, the Grand Wizard, he doesn't even finish second.
Ladies and gentlemen, the second runner-up. The Grand Wizard.
Now, in spite of all that, I can defend the booking of this and having the Grand Wizard come in third. It was Captain Lou Albano who finished in second place, And Arnold Skolin ended up winning the Manager of the Year for 1977, even though his man lost the championship of the promotion during that year, and he really didn't do anything else. But okay, that's fine. So why would Wizard finish third instead of second? Well, it has to do with the angle that occurred at the trophy presentation to Arnold Skolin, because there's a trophy, and it's a pro wrestling show. The trophy's going to get destroyed. That is true, whether it be the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, whatever decade you're talking about, that is going to happen. The angle is Captain Lou is very upset about losing to Skolin, rightfully so. It also, by the way, makes sense from the perspective of Captain Lou being the more cool, quote-unquote, heel than the Grand Wizard is. I think maybe more people were fond of Captain Lou in some sort of way, which, of course, his babyface turn is still years away. But it makes sense from this perspective. After the trophy is presented to Skolin, Albano takes it and he breaks it apart. And what he does is he shoves Arnold Skolin out of the ring. Not really revolutionary stuff, and he's throwing a tantrum. Where this is different from any other angle of this time period is he chucks Vince McMahon, or pushes him, maybe more accurately. Vince Jr. takes a bump over the top rope as part of that ceremony and that angle, which is unheard of because he doesn't take another bump again at least until 1991, when he gets hit with the chair at the commentary position by Ric Flair, who was going at Roddy Piper. So just kind of an interesting thing. And I wonder if that is hidden from public view, if it's not publicized as one of the first Vince's getting physically involved, because, well, is it because Vince Sr. didn't want that for his kid? Well, he wouldn't have let it happen if he didn't want it out there, and it made the angle more effective. I think that they kind of wanted to sweep this under the rug to maybe make the Vince, the Mr. McMahon character later on, more effective and more fresh. I don't know, but it's just something really interesting to look at from a historical perspective.
'Cause we can't see eye to eye. There ain't no good guy. There ain't no bad guy. There's only you and me, and we just disagree.
I'm guessing that Dave Mason was more of a fan of the Attitude Era rather than what was going on in the 70s with all of this talk of there ain't no good guys and there ain't no bad guys. I don't know. I'm just kind of guessing on that. For our next bout, we have Johnny Rivera, who would go on to greater fame as one of the invaders in Puerto Rico, not the infamous invader. That would be number one. He was invader number three, teaming up with Pete Austin, who, second most famous Austin in WWF history, I think is the best he could hope for. But he is a guy named Pete, and he is billed from Boston, so he's okay by me. They are taking on the team of Dynamite Jack Evans and Pretty Boy Larry Sharp. As for Evans, in researching his career, he just kind of seems like an average sort of guy for the 70s. Really kind of nameless and faceless until around 79, when he puts on a mask as Mr. X and becomes slightly more interesting, because that's how it works with masks. If you put on a mask and you're Mr. and it's a single letter, not Mr. JL, that's not going to work. It's going to be Mr. X, Mr. Y. They should form like a faction, like the Algebra Gang or something like that. I don't know. I really don't think it would get over, particularly with the kids. And Pretty Boy Larry Sharp is primarily known as a trainer from the Monster Factory later on. The fact that he's called Pretty Boy is usually a signal. It's like when you call the big guy Tiny or something like that. He's really, really weird looking. Like he's, when they show him right before the match, he kind of has that same look on his face as Private Pyle in Full Metal Jacket, where he's trying not to laugh at Sergeant Hartman.
Do you think I'm cute, Private Pyle? Do you think I'm funny?
Sir, no, sir.
Then wipe that disgusting grin off your face.
Sir, yes, sir.
Well, honey, God, sweetheart.
Sir, I'm trying, sir.
Private Pyle, I'm going to give you 3 seconds. Exactly 3 seconds to wipe that stupid-looking grin off your face, or I will gouge out your eyeballs and skull you.
Not sure if that type of sequence would have ever happened in the Monster Factory. This Larry Sharp should not be confused with the would-be 2016 Libertarian Party vice presidential nominee Larry Sharp, who lost out on his bid to be on the ticket to former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. And it's a shame, because when you're running third party for president, you probably don't want to go on TV and alienate all your would-be voters who feel that the two-party system is broken by saying that you could vouch for Hillary Clinton 10 days before the election. Yeah, that actually happened, so felt a little burned by that. That Larry Sharp is actually running for governor of New York this year. The wrestler Larry Sharp passed away in 2017. Evans and Sharp don't really have a name, the two of them together. They're kind of the late 70s equivalent of what you'd see a decade later as the Conquistadors or the Bolsheviks. Guys on the heel side who will pick up wins on TV from time to time, but would generally lose to just about every other name team in the promotion. And I thought about it, and it's like, it's strange that I can't come up with any examples past 1990, which is the last time we would see the Bolsheviks, because I just can't really envision this type of team on that level. Later on, I thought of Bo Dallas and Curtis Axel, but they don't really seem to even pick up wins on television the same way. I mean, who knows? They might on Main Event, but I stopped watching Main Event once they started delaying it 3 weeks on the network. The catcalls and whistles from the crowd when Evans and Sharp take off like their jumpsuits and robes and stuff, it's all kind of funny to me. I don't quite get it. It seems like a crowd thing that they would do during this time period. Evans and Sharp show some teamwork early on, cutting off the ring with Austin in there, hair pulls, all that sort of stuff. Dumbass Rivera comes running into the ring to complain when really nothing egregious is happening. As I said, hair pulling might have been the most egregious offense by the heel team. A backdrop, and then Sharp tags out to Evans, who then goes for a second backdrop, but it's countered with a sunset flip for the ages as they kind of go a little bit too far across the ring and they end up in the ropes on that sunset flip. Finally, Austin gets out of there and tags to Rivera, who gets in a little bit more mild. He gets in some mild offense, and you can tell that he's the captain of this team, so he's not going to be eating the pin. He's the guy who's more valued. But he's also a victim of their teamwork, but he gets a little bit more offense back, including the worst stinger splash ever. I wasn't quite sure what to call it. He kind of lands about 4 feet in front of him, sort of like a baseball player throwing a pitch that bounces in front of home plate. Be fine in cricket, but not here. There are illegal cheap shots as the referee is distracted, so they are turning up the cheating a little bit. Rivera does end up making a tag to Austin. At this point in my notes, I just wrote, thank God, please, please end this already, because I know Austin is eating the pin. Can we just get to this? And there's no more double team. It kind of breaks down, of all things, as Rivera jumps back in, all four men in the ring. Rivera is shot out of the ring. Sharp scores with a back elbow and a body slam. And Evans goes up to the top rope and lands the knee drop, which is a fairly common 1970s finisher that still holds up to some point, although you don't really see it as much later on, because I think it can be a little bit hard move to kind of execute properly. And that gets a 3 count, and I thank God for that. You can kind of tell that maybe Evans and Sharp, there aren't exactly big plans for them based on this match and kind of their style or whatever. And also, another tell is that they don't have a manager and they are heels in the WWWF. So that just says to me that we don't have anything for you guys. You're just kind of continue to float along and cash them checks.
They come here tonight to scout the Chiefs, the toughest team in the Federal League.
For our final bout, we have Moose Monroe teaming with longtime veteran Baron Mikel Cicluna, taking on the Chiefs. Yes, High Chief Peter Maivia and Chief J Strongbow. I'll get to them in a second and how that team ended up forming. There's a lot more on Baron Cicluna if you listen to the Titans of Wrestling podcast. I always liked the way Parv would pronounce Baron Cicluna's name. But his last win in the WWF that I could find was in 1983, which is when he had his last match. And it was against somebody by the name of Pete Best. And I thought, holy crap, he loses to Baron Cicluna in 1983. And this is two decades after he lost the Loser Leaves the Beatles match against Ringo Starr. I guess they really kicked him out of the band because he was a good-looking guy named Pete. And we all know how tough it is out there for all of us. Now, the two Chiefs here, they would have a lot more success than the 1977 Kansas City Chiefs, who went 2-12 in the National Football League. Maybe not as much as the Charlestown Chiefs in Slapshot. Now, Strongbow was a tag team champ for much of 1977, alongside Billy White Wolf, who decided to leave the WWF as a champion because he hated Chief J Strongbow so much. And apparently, you know, a lot of guys didn't like Strongbow. There were others who were allied with him, but he was a staple of the territory for a very long time. Billy White Wolf, of course, would go on to become Sheik Adnan LKC and General Adnan later on. So he would show up Strongbow by later main eventing a WWF pay-per-view at SummerSlam 1991. And the circumstances in which he left, he was injured via Ken Patera's swinging full Nelson. And this is something, you know, a lot of podcasts like to say, oh, we do this, you'll only hear it here. I have exclusive audio of what led to the breakup of Chief J Strongbow and Billy White Wolf.
Joe owned the Chiefs.
Owns.
I don't know.
Should be said that Jay Strongbow's real name is Joe Scarpa, so that's why he would be calling him Joe in that case. And it just broke down even more to a point where Billy expressed frustration over the whole deal and just left.
I don't care who owned the Chiefs. I hate it here. Make me sick, my allergy. Puke every time. Like that. Puke.
It's just shocking to learn that not only did Billy White Wolf not care for Strongbow, but that he might have had some sort of problems with his allergies and whatnot that caused him to leave. It's why you listen to this show, quite frankly. The High Chief Peter Maivia had come into the WWWF in 77 as a very popular babyface. Of course, now he's primarily known as the grandfather to Dwayne The Rock Johnson, but he was quite a performer back in his day. His highlight during his run in the New York territory would be about a year later when he would turn on Bob Backlund in a tag match and then create one of Backlund's first opponents as champion later in 1978. He also has a giant bandage on his head here that's covering approximately 79% of his forehead. I didn't, you know, get out the ruler or anything like that, but Vince doesn't explain what it is up front, but he says that there'll be an explanation at some point, so I guess I'll have to take that at face value. Maivia, he's fired up early, chases Cicluna out to the apron. Then he and Strongbow share what can only be classified as a very awkward man hug. I don't think Chief J Strongbow is ever lacking for awkwardness in everything that he does. One thing about Strongbow that kind of goes unremarked upon, because a lot of people crap on him for being a terrible worker, and it depends on how you would define it. He doesn't do very much in the ring. But the thing that I can't get past is his trunks are horrible. I hate that design. It's like this like fake weave thing that he's got. Ugh, they just look ugly. Like, ugh, whatever. And he prances around the ring a little bit, and he does like a mini version of the war dance thing. And it reminds me, oh yeah, that thing he was doing when he saved Tatanka, or was trying to, in 1994, where he could barely move. Yeah, he's moving at about the same rate in 1977. He just happens to be a little bit thinner. Maia Villa is going to do most of the work in this match, by God, and it is for the good of the nation, I think. Between these two guys, Maia Villa and Strongbow, there's absolutely no comparison in the bloodlines, because Maia Villa, his son, is Rocky Johnson, and as I said, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, so a lot of firepower on that side, whereas on the other side, Chief J. Strongbow's son, not quite living up to the billing years down the road. Strongbow and the Baron do a crisscross spot, and then they just sort of stop, like they had come to a red light and the pedestrians have to cross. I didn't quite understand that. Maia Villa, thankfully, back in. He works over Cicluna for a little bit, and then both guys tag out, so Moose Monroe is in there against Strongbow. And Moose starts choking with his strap or something or other, and then an Irish whip. And Strongbow slowly crawls between Moose's legs. He can, like, barely get through because he's too wide and Moose can't keep his legs far enough apart. And I... This is just really weird. But I have to hand it to Strongbow in one regard, is the fact that he was able to actually be as over as he was while doing as little as he was. It would be hypocritical of me to not admire that, because I've said in the past that if you can get over to the greatest extent possible while doing nothing, you should do that, because why do a lot when you can do a little and accomplish the same thing? I guess that might be like the worst possible message to send to somebody, but hey, if I can, my goal in life is to make the most possible money that I can while doing the absolute least that I can. That doesn't mean going out and buying lottery tickets, so there's really no path for me to do that. A running body press by Maia Villa on Moose Monroe gets a quick three count. Dick Worley with just a type of three count, a very, very fast count. I think the heels would have had an argument if they had appealed or something. Finally, with the match over, Vince gets around to actually explaining the bandage on the head of High Chief Peter Maia Villa.
Maia Villa and Jay Strongbow victorious. We said before the match began we would make note as to the bandaged forehead of Peter Maia Villa. That is a result of an altercation between himself and superstar Billy Graham, which we will have more commentary on in the weeks to come.
This was actually a little confusing, because on the history of WWE.com, there's a run-in between Maia Villa and superstar Graham listed for the October 22nd show. However, that show is on YouTube. It's cut about 6 minutes shorter than this one, so I'm thinking it might have had to have been taken out of the footage there. I think it aired on the prior week's show, but Vince seems to be very cagey about when stuff actually aired, and that might have something to do with the fact that things were airing at different times all around the territory. In Boston, I guess these were on a delay of a week or two after New York and Philadelphia, and that's something that would last for a few years. Then Vince goes into total filibuster mode, where he's talking like Vince McMahon, like, in the weeks to come, notwithstanding, blah, 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 blah. And then he kind of wraps it up by letting us know what's going to be on next week's show. Again, not telling us when the manager of the year is going to be wrapping up, not telling us how we can cast our vote for manager of the year, just saying that the Grand Wizard has been here and has made his case. And that's how he wraps for WWWF Championship Wrestling for October 29th, 1977. Few plugs for some of my pals out there in podcast land on the Our Vantage Point podcast this week. They tackle one of my favorite subjects, trashing Shawn Michaels, this time for his knee injury, quote unquote, from early 1997 that kept him out of WrestleMania 13, except for the fact that it really didn't, because he still came down and did commentary. On the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis make confessions about their time in the wrestling industry, things that they don't necessarily like, where we learn that Brian Malonis is no Bailey when it comes to one certain human interaction. And on the Place to Be podcast, on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, they cover WrestleMania 4. That one is quite a doozy. I'm looking forward to jumping back on the Place to Be podcast for the April 1988 Saturday Night's Main Event, which is also the first one of that series that they ever did without the benefit of Hulk Hogan. And on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we had a lot of different shows drop in the past week. Standing out to me is the Mount Olympus show with Kelly Nelson and Pete Schermacher, talking about holy grails in wrestling, talking about how these hidden gems have been added to the WWE network, the Last Battle of Atlanta a couple of years ago, and they've built off that. As for me, my holy grail is simply more entertaining episodic wrestling television in full, like the full episode. I'd have to say that maybe it would be the first episode of Greetings from Allentown, which is the September 27th, 1986 Superstars, which came off YouTube over a year ago, and I can't find it anywhere as of now. I really would like to go back and watch that and maybe even listen to my first podcast again and how different the show was and how much shorter it was and how fewer tangents would go on. That the hook of that show was the superstar Billy Graham return, which only lasted one match because apparently he got injured during that match, which, you know, had to have been expected by all involved. Also, would like to remind you to give me a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music, whatever. It really helps to get the word about this show out there. Also on message boards, too, as I had mentioned with the 605 Super Podcast board on Facebook. Give a shout-out to Greetings from Allentown if the question comes up of what podcast you might be listening to. You know why? Because you're actually listening to me right now. You're actually hearing the words that I'm saying. So just spread the word in any possible way that you can. Now, with all that in mind, time for the dramatic return of one of the fan-favorite segments of Greetings from Allentown, YouTube Comment Theater. And there are quite a few comments on this video, as there tends to be for the stuff from the 70s and the very early 80s. There is an audience out there who really likes this stuff and really, really hates anything that's modern, which they would define as the last 20 years, and they have things to say. As always, these are actual comments pulled from the video in question. Start with Steve Holston says, Lou Albano before he started wearing the rubber bands. That looks stupid. That was the youngest I've saw Dusty wrestle that I can remember. Yeah, I didn't even notice that Albano didn't have the rubber bands. I'm not sure when he brought that in. It had to have been probably 1980, is what I might guess. The youngest I've ever seen Dusty Rhodes in any footage that I've seen is actually in Vern Gagne's The Wrestler, where Dusty and Dick Murdoch just steal every scene that they're in. They're like Ken Jeong in The Hangover. Well, maybe even as funny, actually. Johnny Bertraglia is very confused. Is Butcher Vachon really Mad Dog Vachon? Like, no, just because they have the same last name, they are actually two different people. LB 2.0 says, man, it's always cool and refreshing to go back and watch wrestling from the territory days. And I'm thinking, yeah, that is correct, and I should do more shows from this time period, even though we only had one promo and it was just a bunch of matches. Brian Senti says, gotta love the Baron's object. Every week it seemed no one would ever see this object except his opponent. I didn't really cover it during the play-by-play of the match, I don't think, because I didn't really find it all that important, but Baron Cicluna would do the Memphis Jerry Lawler thing of having the foreign object in his hand, but nobody would ever actually see it. It's kind of a psychological play on the crowd, and people would react to it. LFD254 says, wow, thanks for posting this. In Queens, New York, we used to only be able to get the WWWF on the Spanish UHF channel out of Newark, New Jersey. I think it was WNJU Channel 47. Hey, just the same way that I used to watch ECW back in the day. But later, Championship Wrestling would air on WOR Channel 9 in New York, which was actually out of Secaucus. Absolute Boar says, Joe Turco always performed, especially with his numerous groupies. Now, I don't know about that. He's probably making that up. I don't think Joe Turco had any ring rats on the side. Hey, it's my buddy, Keith Langston, the voice of Greetings from Allentown, says, just imagine if on January 23rd, 1984, we witnessed the birth of Dusty Mania. I think all would have been right with the world. Perhaps, but for the reasons that I spelled out during the Dusty match, that was a marriage I don't think that was going to work between him and Vince. Torn Mask says, the Grand Wizard of Wrestling should have been voted Manager of the Year. Enough said. And I think we can all agree on that. And finally, Mystic Wizard says, don't interrupt the Grand Wizard, McMahon. Yes, Vince was interrupting him at certain points, and I think the Wizard could have gone on for 7 or 8 minutes making his case, and McMahon's interruptions, I might argue, actually cost him the Manager of the Year award. That's just one man's opinion. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. As for next week's show, I've had this idea for a very long time. It's been in the queue of shows that I've wanted to do, and it feels like it's perfect timing right now. The reason being that the second season of the TV show GLOW will be dropping on Netflix on Friday, June 29th, so the day after the next show will be released. So my thought is maybe to go back to the original GLOW all the way to the beginning and cover the pilot episode of The Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. It was filmed in late 1985. I feel like it would be very interesting to kind of take a look at that, compare it to the television series, perhaps give my thoughts on the television series that, as I saw the first season. I'm actually going through a rewatch of it again now. The documentary that's on Netflix on The Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. It's something a little different. It's a little off the beaten path, but I advise, you know, please bear with me on that, because I think that just in going through that pilot episode, there are a few humorous things going on that I'll certainly have something to say about. But do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
We certainly hope you enjoyed the wrestling action this week on Championship Wrestling. Join us next week for more of the same.